From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jane Clayson in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. China is battling its biggest surge in COVID cases since the pandemic began. And Beijing is pushing the lockdown button again. The zero-tolerance approach is now restricting tens of millions of people in four major cities. And a whole province in northeast China, a manufacturing hub, is also closed off. Let's get an update now from NPR's Emily Feng in Beijing. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Scott.
China has contained previous outbreaks with its zero tolerance policy, but this seems to be a fierce outbreak. How worrying is it?
It is very worrying, and that's because we're seeing outbreak levels that are exceeding what we saw during Wuhan's lockdown in early 2020. So even back when this pandemic started, the numbers that we saw in China then, which sent people into a panic, are less than the numbers we're seeing now. Of course, we have more than 2 years experience now dealing with COVID. China has put down numerous Delta and Omicron outbreaks in the last few months. So they have experience, but it's just the sheer numbers that we've seen. You know, more than 4,000 cases alone today in Jilin province, more than 10,000 in the last 2 weeks across the country, which doesn't sound like a lot if you're in the U.S., but for China, which has seen a handful of cases every day, every week for the last few months, this is a staggering amount.
Tell us a little bit more about the containment efforts in key places. As I look at the affected cities you've been reporting on, I see Shenzhen, the tech capital of China, as it were, Shanghai, a financial capital, and Changchun in the northeast, which is a giant auto manufacturing hub.
Right. At first, they tried to lock down key neighborhoods. So anywhere where a case appeared, they would quarantine that person and then 2 degrees of close contacts. But particularly in the northernmost province, so many people started testing positive that the government ran out of isolation space. If you need to test, trace, and isolate every single contact in their close contact, you quickly run out of places to put them. So people there were reporting horror stories of how they were stuck in their office for days at a time or forced to quarantine in like their basement garage because there weren't quarantine facilities open. In other places that are less heavily affected but are under soft lockdown policies, people have already canceled in-person schooling. So in Beijing and Shanghai, everything is now online again indefinitely. In Shenzhen, where they're under total lockdown, residents are being told to stay at home. One person from each family can go out once a day to buy food.
Wow.
And then everyone in that city now has to get tested at least 3 times before they're allowed to resume normal activity there. In the case of Shenzhen, it appears that many of the cases came from Hong Kong nearby. Hong Kong, if you remember, is still in the throes of a public health meltdown. They logged almost 26,000 cases today. That's in a city of 7 million people. They now have the highest COVID fatality rate in the world.
Wow.
So that's a really strong warning for authorities in mainland China about how disastrous a failure to contain COVID right now in the mainland could be, because Hong Kong is already going through a nightmare.
I understand some public health officials are suggesting trying to take a different approach. Can you tell us about Dr. Zhang Wenhong and what he is saying?
There have been a number of pretty prominent medical voices over the last 2 years saying zero tolerance policies, zero COVID, they're not sustainable in the long term because we're always going to be playing whack-a-mole with containing small outbreaks, or large ones in this case. Zhang Wenhong is one of these people who has been promoting a live with COVID approach, but gradually getting there. So he is advocating for high vaccination rates with mRNA vaccines in some cases, and then slowly learning to live with the virus. He just penned an essay a few days ago as cases were starting to spike, saying that it wasn't quite the moment just yet to open up completely and treat COVID as endemic, but that this latest outbreak was a sign of how China would need to develop more sustainable long-term policies. But these voices are in the minority. People are still very much in support of zero-tolerance COVID policies, and people are really scared right now about the outbreaks.
Yeah. Well, there's the question of virus contagion. But can I ask you briefly, Emily, about economic contagion? You're describing key economic hubs in China where these lockdowns or partial lockdowns are. And we see investors are already dumping Chinese stocks, anticipating potential sanctions against the Chinese economy for Beijing's alliance with Russia. What are the economic sources telling you?
So far, China has shown that it's able to bounce back and minimize economic impact, even when COVID breaks out in manufacturing or export-oriented hubs. So there have been numerous outbreaks already in China's south, where a lot of the goods that we buy from China are made and shipped. So precedent is on China's side. Unfortunately, we're just seeing numbers that are so much larger across such a widespread of provinces. But it could be an inflection point where leaders might be forced to concede zero COVID is no longer possible, and they may have to learn to gradually open up to living with COVID.
Emily Feng is NPR's correspondent in Beijing. Emily, thank you for staying late to talk to us. Thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
Well, the humanitarian crisis in Ukraine has prompted many outside of that country to try to help by donating money. But how do you know if you're giving to a legitimate charity? Michelle Singletary has some guidance. She's a personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. Michelle, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, give us a sense of the legitimate charities that you're hearing about and what kinds of things the money is going toward in Ukraine.
So lots of them are obviously providing food and water, trying to find shelter for the victims. And so, you know, they're on the ground. They understand the needs. And that's why it's important that as you're thinking about giving, make sure you give to a charity that has a history of this kind of help. Because sometimes people will send things that aren't needed, or it's difficult to get it to the people who need it the most. And the scammers, of course, don't care about any of that. They just are looking to get money from you using crisis like what's happening in Ukraine.
And also using social media. I mean, this has become an increasingly popular platform for scammers. Explain what's happening and why.
Yeah, it's a cheap way for them to find people. They are hacking people's email. I mean, literally this yesterday evening, I was helping a friend reclaim her email box from someone who had hacked into it and was sending messages, sent one to me asking for money. And so they can go on, they can see all your friends, and they will send you an email or a text message or something with a link. People innocently click it, not realizing it's fake. They then, you know, co-opt your phone or your email address, send messages to your friends, and then next thing you know, you're trying to help them out. You send money, and now you've been scammed. Yeah.
Well, and this happened to you. What did you do about it? How'd you handle it?
Well, you know, it was my Instagram account. They created a fake account and started sending personal messages to my friends. So I got the account taken down, but not before, you know, got some stressful calls from friends saying, you know, you okay? What's going on? You know, why am I getting these messages? And I mean, just I don't know anybody who doesn't have a friend whose accounts haven't been hacked or they've not been approached by a scammer. And so, you know, we're trying to find a way to get people to safety when it comes to these scams. But, you know, this is what I tell people. Trust nothing. If your mama sends you a text message, call her and say, did you send me a text message? You know, just verify everything. Click nothing. I don't care how legitimate it looks. Get out of that email. Get out of that text message. Go to the actual source, your bank. Call your friend to make sure it's legitimate. You've got to be paranoid. That is your protection against these scammers.
You write, Michelle, that the educational tools that the state and federal law enforcement have provided to avoid scams is good, but, quote, it's like killing cockroaches, you say, because these scammers are constantly finding new ways to defraud us. How do you keep up?
You know, I hate to be pessimistic, but we can't. So all we can do is just be in protection mode. And I personally, myself, I have, you know, my family members, we all text each other. So we have a group text message. And so every week I've been sending them messages about new scams and things coming that come into me. And I say, you know, and I keep them up to date on that. So if you're that person in your family, you know, designate someone that sort of just, you know, takes the pulse of what's going on. I do the same thing with my church. I have a monthly financial literacy program, and I've been doing scam alerts because it's so, we like to blame the victims, like, how can they be so stupid? You know, these things seem obvious, but they're not that obvious. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if you get a call from Amazon saying someone charged $1,000 on your card, all you hear is you've got someone charging $1,000 on your card. You don't sort of stop to think, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. Right. And they use fear and intimidation and the fact that people don't want to lose money, and all common sense goes out the window because you're scared. And so that's why I say trust nothing. I mean, I just can't stress that enough. Not anything.
So help
until
us,
you independently check it.
Well, so help us make educated choices. How do you independently check? And what if someone wants to financially support the people of Ukraine? How do you know if you've got a legitimate charity in about 20 seconds?
So don't listen to anyone who calls or the text messages. Go to the actual website. Don't use the number. Go on online, find the number, call them yourselves. If it's coming from your bank, look on the back of your credit card or your debit card and call the bank. That is the way you're going to protect yourself.
And you can go to hereandnow.org, where we'll link Michelle's column. You can find some legitimate charities that are helping the people of Ukraine. Michelle Singletary is a personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. Michelle, great advice. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, basketball fans, have you heard of Lucia or Lucy Harris? Well, she won three straight college championships with her team in the 1970s. She represented the U.S. at the 76 Olympics, and she was drafted by a team in the NBA. No kidding. Lucy Harris narrates her own story in the documentary, The Queen of Basketball.
Born in a small town in South Mississippi in 1955. Became a great female basketball player. At one time, was the greatest in the United States. As a matter of fact, the New Orleans Jazz drafted Lucy. The first woman to be drafted by a men's basketball team.
The Queen of Basketball was directed by Ben Proudfoot, produced for the New York Times OpDocs. And it's up for an Oscar in the Best Documentary Short Subject category. And one of the executive producers joins us now. Turns out he's 7 feet one, goes by Shaq. Shaquille O'Neal, welcome to Here and Now.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. You signed on to this project after watching part of the documentary, I'm guessing to spread the word about this incredible basketball life. Surely you have to pick carefully what you promote. So why pick Lucia Harris and put her story out there?
Well, I mean, I like to invest in things that's going to change people's lives. And, you know, what is so special about this film, that such an intimate experience. And the thing I can't believe, this precious archive, I've never seen footage of Lucy playing. It was just magical to watch. You know, Ben and his team, they dug up the archives from long lost history, and to the point to where even her kids have, you know, never seen it.
Is that right?
Yeah, her kids have never seen the footage. So when they saw the documentary, there was tears everywhere.
Oh, wow.
The reason Lucy's career was stuffed in a box in archive is that it's simple. Women athletes, especially Black women athletes, have been historically shortchanged and denied opportunities. And this film will fill in the gap in the history of basketball by finally letting Lucy tell her story. I always thought I was a basketball aficionado. And the fact that I never heard of this woman who won three championships and who scored the first basket in the Women's Olympics in 1976. And I was like, who is this woman? I never heard of her. So when I watched the documentary, I was like, Ben, you got to let me help you get the word out.
Yeah. Well, you said tears were shed. I watched it last night with my wife, and it's an emotional story. How did you react when you first saw this?
I was shocked. Listen, I've seen a lot of great women basketball players, but the fact that we never heard this woman, I think it was a shame. But, you know, in the world we live in now, information can be spread fast. And, you know, this woman needs to be recognized. She needs to be honored. And I'm going to help her and her family do that. You know, we just wanted to resurrect the career of one of the greatest American athletes of the 20th century.
Well, let's talk a little about her life. Lucy Harris was the child of sharecroppers. She learned to play basketball with her brothers, and she became a star at Delta State. But as she said in the film, she was the only black player on her team.
Being the only black on the team, I had to adjust to that. I wasn't really close to anybody on the team, but once we got on that floor, you couldn't tell.
What was it like for you to hear that part of her story?
We celebrate these athletes now, but those are not the greatest stories. The greatest stories of triumph and, you know, the ones with Muhammad Ali, Bill Russell, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. When I first met Bill Russell, he told me stories of how he couldn't stay in the same hotel with his teammates. And in my mind, I was like, to have to go through that and still win 11 championships, you must be the greatest player. Like, those are real stories to me. These stories now, a guy makes $60, $70 million a year. We don't have the problems that these athletes had. Yeah, all these athletes is making money, including myself. We need to recognize where we came from and how we got here. You know, a lot of people fighting for us and standing up for us to the point to where we can make $30, $40 million just to shoot a basketball when you got the greatest players in the world having to fight and stay in different rooms and discrimination and, you know, racism and misogynism. They had to deal with all that. And that's what makes them greater than we could ever be.
Well, Lucy Harris went through all that, and her college team won the collegiate title three times in the 1970s. She was on the U.S. Olympic team in 1976 in Montreal and scored the first basket at those games. There is great archival footage of her dominating on the inside. What part of her game struck you? Similar at all to yours?
Yeah, she was very ferocious. She played with a lot of tenacity. And listen, she had to let it all out while dealing with so much. And, you know, but she wasn't scared. I'm sure, I don't know for a fact she had a lot of threats. She better do this, she didn't do that. She's like, nope, I'm going to play this game, win, and I want you people to know my name. And they know her name. And if they didn't know her name, they know her name now.
Lucy Harris was 6'3", and I was looking on some of the height percentile charts, and that, you know, puts her in the 99th percentile. Just like you are, I'm sure you never thought about whether she could have scored on you.
No, she couldn't have scored on me. Not at all.
Never?
Yes.
How about her numbers? I looked at some of her statistics. 1 year in college, she averaged, I think, 31 points and 15 rebounds. How do your numbers stack up against her? You never thought about that either.
No, her numbers were way better than my numbers. Way better. She was so good that the people used to watch her games and not the men's game.
Right. That was in the documentary, right? That people showed up in the arena to watch the women's games far more than the men's games when she was there. Really something.
Yes, she was awesome.
She was drafted by the Jazz, but declined to try out because she felt she couldn't compete on a man's team. Did you think that was the right call? Because I'm thinking, why not?
It was more on the basis that she wanted to be with her family. At that point, she was probably like, look, I did all I can in college. Like sometimes you fight until you just say, I don't want to fight anymore. And, you know, her family was important. She's like, you know what? I want to just spend time with my family. You know, she probably said I couldn't compete. That was probably her a way of, you know, letting herself down easily. Trust me, she could have competed. But she's like, you know, deal with this stuff for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 more years or just go raise my family. Mm-hmm. Richard, I'll take raise my family for $200.
Yeah. Of course, back then there was no WNBA. And
none
Lucy Harris found herself for a little bit without a job for a while. She later got a job at her university. But in the film, I mean, she has this gleaming face, the smiling face. But to me, her face gets sad at that moment when she talks about that chapter in her life.
When I realized I don't have a job. To just try to make it, you know, to just try to make a living for myself and for my family. I was looking for a coaching job and just having a feeling of not wanting to be there, not wanting to be where I am. I think it took its toll. I had a nervous breakdown. And I had to return home.
She probably had to, you know, endure a lot. I probably had to endure a lot. And a lot of times when you give yourself to the world, all you want is recognition. All you want is, hey, man, good job. Hey, you're the best. Hey, this and that. I don't think she was getting that. Of course, she was getting it from her family. But you know, a lot of times we sacrifice ourselves for the love of the game. At least, hey, man, good game. Or, well, you're the best ever.
Well, this documentary is nominated for an Oscar, and I read you wanted to give Lucy a red carpet moment. And tragically, she died in January. What did you think when you got that news?
Yeah, I was saddened. You know, for me, it was what I've been saying after the death of my sister and Kobe Bryant, that I was going to stop procrastinating. And, you know, we was talking to Lucy, we were trying to get things done, and I would always say, I'm going to come see you next week. Next time I'm in Houston, I'll come see you. And then, you know, she just passed away. I would have loved to just see her and give her a hug, but we'd have sent the plane, the limo, we'd have had the flowers for her walking when she walked. So it would have definitely been a, you know, a surreal moment for her and her family.
Yeah. Well, finally, Shaquille O'Neal, you've said that you want women athletes, women to watch this, perhaps all of us to watch this. What do you want us to take away from this documentary?
I just want people to, I want women to see how far we've come. Because sports is always supposed to be a fair space, place of equality. It's supposed to be about merit, talent. It should be a place that's free of racism, misogyny, free of inequality. This is the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Title IX. It could not be a better time to reassess how we're doing on that. Is it really equal pay? Just want people, and then also want people to know and understand that, hey, you may have heard of Cheryl Miller and, you know, all these other ladies, but before that, she was the Bill Russell of women. So I just want people to know and understand that.
Shaquille O'Neal is, of course, a basketball legend, and he's also executive producer of The Queen of Basketball. It has been nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Short. Shaquille, it's a great product. Thanks for taking the time.
All right. Thank you.
Lucia Harris, remember the name. And you can check out The Queen of Basketball at hereandnow.org.
A 30-year-old man is in custody in Washington, D.C., following a series of attacks targeting homeless men there and in New York City. At least five men were shot, two of them fatally, earlier this month. Reporter Martin Ostermuhl is covering the story for WAMU in D.C. Martin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get to the suspect, what do we know about these attacks in New York and Washington?
Well, they happened over the last 2 weeks. Most of them happened in the early morning hours. They were unprovoked. Like you said, it was five separate attacks in which folks who were experiencing homelessness were shot. In two of those cases, one in D.C. and one in New York, the people who were attacked did end up dying.
The police just identified the suspect as 30-year-old Gerald Brevard. What do we know about him, Martin?
We know he's a 30-year-old D.C. resident. We know that according to court records, he does have a history of arrests, including for some assaults in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. We also know that in 2019, he underwent a psychiatric evaluation at a psychiatric hospital in the district, but a doctor did find him at the time to be competent to stand trial. Above and beyond that, a lot is still to come out about who he is and why he did this. The mayor and the police chief and some federal officials will be holding a press conference later this afternoon to fill the public in on some of the details regarding the arrest and who Mr. Brevard is and why he may have done this.
And why do police think the shootings in these two cities, hundreds of miles apart, were perpetrated by the same person?
Well, they actually didn't know until late last week, and the only reason that they actually came to this conclusion that it was there, that the attacks were linked, is that a police officer in D.C. who had been investigating the killing here in the city saw on social media that there had been a very similar killing in New York City. So he connected the dots, and by the next day, they had actually started this joint investigation, and they connected the gun that was used in the two fatal incidents. So it was ballistics evidence, but it was essentially from a social media hunch from a police captain here in the district that kind of brought things together.
And these attacks and killings seem to have really struck a chord with people in both cities. The mayors and police departments pleaded for information from citizens. D.C. even offered a $70,000 reward for information. Tell us a little bit about this very unusual investigation.
Right. I mean, these are two cities where homicides have been on the rise over the last 2 years. So, you know, violence is not something that is necessarily new, neither is gun violence. But the fact that this involved people who are experiencing homelessness, who are additionally vulnerable, struck a chord. And I think people responded to that. There was an immediate sense that what was happening here was targeted. They were targeting people who had done nothing wrong, who were just there minding their business, sleeping in just about every single case. So there was a kind of visceral reaction to that. And that prompted the sort of outpouring of resources and coordination that you don't often see in police investigations. And it was two cities together doing this at the same time. And just yesterday here in Washington, we had the mayor of Washington, the mayor of New York, and their respective police chiefs, plus federal officials, all joining forces to say, we want to catch this guy, and here's images of who this is. Help us.
And is it clear or not that public tips led to an arrest quickly?
Yes, there is a sense that public tips did come in. We're still trying to get more details about how extensive those were and how much federal assistance may have helped also.
That's WAMU crime reporter Martin Ostermuhl on the arrest of a suspect in the shootings of five homeless men in D.C. and New York City, two of them fatal. Martin, really appreciate your reporting. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
As Russia continues to bombard targets in Ukraine, an information war is underway too. To try to control the narrative, the White House last week held a private briefing on Ukraine for 30 social media influencers on the platform TikTok. Taylor Lorenz covers technology and online culture for The Washington Post, and she wrote about the briefing. Taylor, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Now, you talked to some of the 30 TikTok stars who were at this briefing. Here's a little bit of sound you posted from the start of this White House Zoom call. Here's White House Digital Strategy Director Rob Flaherty.
Obviously, we value the work you all are doing, informing your followers of the ongoing events, and we recognize this is a critically important avenue in the way that the American public is finding out about the latest. So we wanted to make sure you had the latest information from us from an authoritative source.
So, Taylor, what key messaging did the White House try to get out here?
Yeah, well, one big thing that they sort of reiterated to all of the TikTokers is that they wanted to avoid war and sort of de-escalate things as much as possible. And then they just kind of explained what was going on, you know, with the situation, what they were trying to do about it. They took some questions from some of the TikTokers as well.
Yeah. And the fact that this briefing happened in the first place, what does this tell us about TikTok in its reach as a media platform today?
Yeah, well, I think more and more people are getting their news from social platforms and specifically TikTok. A lot of people have just been saying this is really the first TikTok war in the sense that, you know, the platform has only been around since the end of 2018. And really, yeah, it hasn't been, you know, until the past year and a half that people really started to use it regularly for news.
Yeah. Well, TikTok has been flooded with videos claiming to be from the front line in Ukraine, and some of it is. There are also Ukrainians like user Zina Solo posting explainers. Here's a little bit of her content on TikTok.
Good evening from Ukraine, everybody. I think it's time we talk about a very complicated topic. Why are the Russians targeting civilians and residential areas in Ukraine? Russians continue horrific, unprovoked, non-stop artillery shellings of huge Ukrainian cities that have millions of people living in them.
Now, watching this, I assume this is her name. I assume she's Ukrainian. I assume she's telling the truth of what she's seeing. But the site is also full of fake or unverified content. Can people really get confused here?
Well, yeah, I think users don't have great media literacy around platforms like TikTok. Tons and tons of false information is rampant. I mean, TikTok has a serious misinformation problem. And I think the nature of video as well almost makes it harder for users to tell what's true or not.
Yeah. And does TikTok say it has the ability to police what's legitimate or not? Or are they just telling us you're kind of on your own here?
I mean, all of these social platforms, users are on their own. Of course, TikTok might remove, you know, really egregious false information about like COVID-19, for instance, but they certainly are not, you know, vetting every video to tell whether it's true or whether it's accurately represented.
Was there an example you remember from this meeting where the White House folks said, listen, this is, we want to focus on this message as either being accurate or inaccurate?
No, it was more questions. So, for instance, you know, just like in a normal press briefing, right, the TikTokers, they get up, they sort of explain what's going on, and then the TikTokers have a chance to ask the question, right? They're the media in this case. So, for instance, Ellie Zeiler, one TikTok star, asked actually about inflation, said, you know, the war in Ukraine, gas prices are crazy, and, you know, how, what should Gen Z feel about inflation? And Jen Psaki responded and kind of gave her an answer saying that they were trying to get it down and da-da-da. But it's just a pretty standard press briefing stuff. So it's just that the media now is TikTok instead of, you know, more traditional media.
All right. Taylor Lorenz covers technology and online culture for The Washington Post. Taylor, thanks for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go to Washington State, where a native group of about 600 people has been fighting for decades to be recognized as a sovereign nation. And now thousands of people across Seattle have joined their cause. Katia Riddle reports.
If you stand on a beach in West Seattle and look across Elliott Bay, you can take in all of downtown. But Ken Workman sees something more.
This is the first place where the white people would have come around and seen native people.
Workman is a member of the Duwamish tribe. He traces his lineage directly back to Chief Seattle. He imagines the day his grandpa, many generations ago, welcomed these boats of white people.
He would have said, "Sla lil," which means come ashore. Come ashore, my friends, onto this land. Sla lil de sea adicha pud.
It's hard to imagine what Chief Seattle would say now.
That's a good question. So I'm going, Grandpa, what were you thinking?
Workman's grandpa signed a treaty with these colonizers. Now, the Duwamish are demanding the federal government make good on that deal. They're asking for federal recognition. Federally recognized tribes can be eligible for a lot of benefits. Healthcare, revenue streams from casinos, education.
I could have gone to school to be a teacher.
Desiree Fagan is also a member of the Duwamish tribe. She's a stay-at-home mom of four. She says she's always wondered how her life might have gone differently had her tribe been recognized. It might have helped her pay for college.
Same as the English M.
Fagan pulls up an app on her phone. She's using it to teach her children the ancestral Duwamish language.
Mi'kmaq.
Mi'kmaq.
Fagan says the struggle to access higher education continues. Her oldest son is now in his first year of college. He received one private scholarship for $2,500.
But $2,500 versus, you know, full tuition being paid with federally recognized tribes, that's a huge difference.
Fagan traces her own history through her Duwamish great-grandma. But treaties and proven Indian lineage are not enough to meet the federal government's criteria for recognition.
Where the problem sits is that they don't account for historical reality.
Josh Reed is a historian of American Indian Studies at the University of Washington. Reed says the longer tribes go unrecognized, the more elusive recognition becomes. That's because the U.S. wants tribes to show long-standing records of things like land or internal government.
That can be really challenging when you're burned out of your homelands or your lands are just simply taken.
That's exactly what the Duwamish argue happened to them after colonization. Not everyone here agrees with that interpretation of history. Some other tribes object to recognition for the Duwamish. The Bureau of Indian Affairs did not respond to interview requests for this story. But the Duwamish have gained allies in their struggle.
Oh, you live or work here in Seattle now, currently? You should be giving money to the Duwamish.
Rosie Wilson-Briggs helped to start a project a few years ago called Real Rent. The idea is that people here voluntarily pay reparations to the tribe directly. No need to wait for the federal government. Wilson-Briggs says it's taken on a life of its own.
It's deeply satisfying. Oh my goodness.
More than 20,000 people are now giving monthly.
So Real Rent itself has been a godsend.
Duwamish elder Ken Workman says the money has helped cover basic expenses. In the years since Real Rent started, the tribe's federally reported annual income has gone from just over $100,000 to more than $1 million. Still, this money is nowhere near the benefit some federally recognized tribes receive. This fight is not just about the money. Back at Elliott Bay, Workman remembers coming here as a child with his younger brother.
This is what it means to be Duwamish, that you're attached to this place, imprinted on this beach.
Workman says it's long past time for the federal government to acknowledge that fact as well. For NPR News, I'm Kadia Riddle in Seattle.
It's been a rough 2 years for the restaurant industry as countless beloved eateries have forced to close their doors. But many others have managed to weather the storm, including Zingerman's, the iconic Ann Arbor-based food business. Zingerman's, which first opened in 1982 as a traditional Jewish deli and food shop, celebrates 40 years today. And joining us now is Micheline Maynard, friend of the show and author of Satisfaction Guaranteed, How Zingerman's Built a Corner Deli into a Global Food Community. Great to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's so nice to be back with you.
Well, exactly 2 years ago, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer ordered restaurants to close their dining rooms. And here we are 2 years later. Zingerman's is still here, still going strong when so many other food businesses are gone. How did they do it, Mickey?
Well, their secret weapon was their mail order business. Their mail order business is about 40% of their annual revenue, and everybody wanted comfort food, and they turned to the Zingerman's catalog and ordered lots and lots of things from the mail order catalog, and that was really what kept them going, at least for the first part of the pandemic.
So that's a great innovation. What other creative initiatives did they take during this time?
During the pandemic, all of the businesses were empowered to just go innovate, cut their product lineups if they had to, change their product lineups, add some things to the menu. They all instituted curbside. They set up outdoor seating areas, literally a park out in front of one of their restaurants, and essentially were allowed to do whatever they thought could support the Zingerman's brand.
Well, those innovation efforts really followed the open book management system at Zingerman's, where everyone in the organization participates in running the business and really makes substantial decisions. For example, dishwashers in the kitchen noticed people weren't eating all their fries at one point, so they made changes. I mean, this is a structure, a management structure, that either really works or I guess really doesn't. How has it worked out for Zingerman's?
Well, everyone there is invited to make suggestions, but it isn't just writing a little slip and putting it in a box. One of the waitresses that I spoke with at Zingerman's Roadhouse came up with an idea for a daily breakfast special because she was assigned to do the breakfast business and didn't feel that they were, you know, getting enough customers in the door. And then she met with the cooks, she met with the managers, and they were able to roll out the blue plate specials for breakfast. And then they subsequently added them for lunch. And now when you go into Zingerman's Roadhouse, you see these big blue plates with that day's special written up on the wall.
Talk about some of the financial losses that Zingerman suffered during the pandemic.
Well, what's interesting is literally 2 years ago today, I was having a meeting with Ari Weinzweig, who's one of the co-founders of Zingerman's, and he came to the meeting and said, "This is the worst day of my life. I've just had to lay off 300 people." Mm-hmm. One of the big problems for them was that the deli, the iconic building on Detroit Street, always had featured what was called the line, and people would literally line up down a pathway through the deli, out the front door, and around the corner. That ended the minute that indoor dining was shut down, and they had to turn to pickup and delivery. And at the beginning, they didn't have a place for people to eat, so people would come and get their sandwiches and sit right on the curb and use their wrappings as placemats. Originally, they were at $70 million. They said they dropped to $45 million overnight, but then they were able to make enough changes. So they only ended up $2 million short for the first fiscal year of the pandemic, which is pretty remarkable.
It is remarkable. You've talked about the last 2 years and sort of the shifts that Zingerman's has made. Talk about 40 years. It's a big deal for a restaurant. How have they evolved over these four decades? And what does that mean for the Ann Arbor community and really beyond?
Well, I joke that Zingerman's is a lot like the University of Michigan, because almost anywhere you go in Ann Arbor, you could turn a corner and there will be a building that's owned by the university. And Zingerman's is a little bit like that. They have their original deli, but then they also have another restaurant called Miss Kim. They have an event space downtown. They have the Roadhouse, which is a few miles away. And the interesting thing is they really didn't grow for the first 10 years. But what was happening was their approach was being copied, and there was kind of a nasty lawsuit about it. And they decided that if people were going to pick out the things that made Zingerman's Zingerman's, that they had better expand so that nobody could copy it all in one fell swoop.
Well, some really remarkable work. Let's go out here with you telling us the best thing to order at Zingerman's.
So everyone asked me if I like a favorite sandwich, and my favorite item is actually a salad called the Z Cobb salad. And those salads are so big, I can get two meals out of them. So I find that very satisfying.
Even better. That's Micheline Maynard, author of Satisfaction Guaranteed, How Zingerman's Built a Corner Deli into a Global Food Community. Mickey, thanks so much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jane Clayson in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.